Hi, I'm Maggie Saldine, peer recovery coach for MindSpring's Health and co-host of the KDNK public affairs show, Chemical World. I had the distinct honor of sitting down recently with Arne Manconi, the program manager for Garfield County Prep, and Diana Andrews, who is the former program manager of Garfield County Prep. Please enjoy this conversation that we had about sexual health in our schools here in the Roaring Fork Valley.
This is the second part of that conversation that aired on KDNK on February 23rd. Enjoy.
Hi, my name is Maggie Saldine. I'm a peer recovery coach for MindSpring's Health. I'm a certified Colorado peer and family specialist, and I'm also the founder and executive director of High Rockies Harm Reduction. So happy to be here chatting with you today.
I'm just Diana Andrews. I used to manage the Garfield County Prep Program, which is a comprehensive sex ed program for middle schoolers and high schoolers. And now I'm running a tobacco prevention grant for Pitkin County Public Health here in Colorado.
And hi, I'm Arne Manconi. I'm the new program manager for Prep in Garfield County. And formerly I ran a national youth development charity that was focused on value-based leadership and outdoor sports education, and I was a...
I've always thought, too, I was a curious, still am a curious person. So if you're not going to teach me what I am curious about, then I'm going to go out and seek out the answer to my curiosity, which could be very risky. So I often, just observing kids in the classroom while they were being taught, you could almost see that once they had the information and the education and their questions were answered, they were less curious. So they didn't need to go out and experiment to get their questions answered. And so I think that's a big component too that maybe isn't talked about enough, that when you quell the curiosity, then there's less experimentation, would be my hypothesis.
You know, Maggie asked the question, how did I learn sex ed, or what was it like? And I'm 61, and I went to Catholic grade schools, so there was a form of education through shame. There was no education. It was no, you grew up believing that you weren't going to have sex until marriage, and that would be the moral choice, the appropriate choice. And I was taught by nuns. And so in high school, then I went to a public high school and I tried to advocate for sex ed taught in our school system as a member of the student government. And that got shut down immediately. And I'll never forget that conversation with the principal, who said, we're not having parents calling in here and telling us this is not happening. And that goes back to what we've been discussing. You know, there is parents are involved in what the choices are, and they're sending their schools. So these programs, the parents can opt out. There's a waiver form mm-hmm. that can be signed. This isn't a top-down approach by government once it's agreed upon. There is still collaboration and cooperation with families.
And I would take it even a step further. The students are empowered, because I've had the experience where students actually convinced their parents to opt them out because they were nervous about the condom demonstration and they didn't want to be a part of that. And so when you back up a little bit, the teachers are very well trained to create a safe environment, and the students are a part of that. First day of every unit starts with class agreements. What do you need to feel safe and participate in this class while you're here? And oftentimes on that list of class agreements is self-care, you know, and we recognize that kids could be triggered from past experiences, so they are given permission to take care of themselves. And if they become uncomfortable, they can leave the room and go see a nurse or go sit in the library, whatever the school has set up. And until they are calm and feeling comfortable again, then they can come back in. So with these two young people, we coach the teacher to talk with the students and the parents and let them know that at any time throughout the lesson, you can decide to remove yourself, but at least you're not removing yourself from everything. So knowing that the classes are specifically set up to be a safe, nurturing environment where kids can exercise self-care and know themselves the best, at least they're not eliminating all of the information. And generally they find it's not as scary as they thought it was going to be, because again, it's medically accurate, it's age appropriate, it's fairly matter of fact.
I'd like to add, Maggie, to your question of what was sex ed like for me. It's still happening.
Yeah.
I'm still learning.
Yeah.
And we could draw a parallel to COVID. We were given information a year ago in March. That some of that information from infectious disease experts changed. We have been trying to operate around what we feel is consensual operating, and whether or not we want to wear masks, not wear masks, go to restaurants, not go to restaurants, etc. It's been politicized, and I think that could help some people understand what I'm learning a few months into this job, is that sexual health, and why I wanted to bring you in, Maggie, brings in addiction. It brings in depression. It brings in suicide, suicide ideation. All of these different pieces, because it's such a, and this is my, it's such a big part of a young person's life as they're going from child to adolescent to adult. And they're not, and I could say this to a certain degree, sex ed or sex health or positive sexuality is not really taught in most school systems around the United States and in Colorado. And we're very fortunate here to have what could be considered a best practice approach, and it's still growing. It's still moving. And
there's a big misconception that if you give kids this information, then they will go and use it.
Right.
And that's a valid concern. I'm not a parent, but I can imagine what it must feel like to have your child entering adulthood, and now you have to admit that your baby is going to become sexually active, and that I would think would be very frightening. And so the myths that are out there that, oh, if you teach them this, then they will begin to be sexually active. And what we have proven is just the opposite. When you look at our pre and post surveys and what the kids are asking us, the vast majority are less likely to much less likely engage in oral, vaginal, or anal sex after having these lessons. Again, I attribute that to be their curiosity has been quelled.
Can I add one other part that I learned last week, for example? If sex health isn't being taught at younger ages, and a young girl is being sexually abused, she can't necessarily describe what is happening to her, to somebody who can help her.
Mm-hmm.
And so another component of sexual health is helping to identify and avert and hopefully stop some forms of sexual abuse.
You teach about body parts. Well, you don't make up funny names for elbows and noses, so why are we making up funny names for vaginas and penises? When kids have that kind of vocabulary, a perpetrator is going to turn away in a hurry because that kid knows too much. They can articulate things, which means they're less likely to keep it a secret because obviously somebody's talking to them to be able to give them this education and vocabulary. So just using the proper anatomical names of all body parts at a very young age, when you're teaching that to toddlers, that is a huge deterrent to that child becoming a child sex abuse victim.
So, Maggie, can I ask you a question as a mental health worker? Shame is a term that comes up a lot more today. We're seeing a lot of changes. When I was teaching youth development and creating curriculum, a lot of it was around resiliency. Now that terminology is more about social-emotional, and we're starting to see more about mindfulness, empathy. And that, to shortcut a conversation for time, a lot of it is by creating awareness around shame. So if there's shame that's created around sexual activity, do you think that it could lead to abuse of alcohol or drugs?
Absolutely. I think that shame and stigma are really what kind of push us down that rabbit hole of unhealthy coping mechanisms. And to kind of summarize a bunch of things I'm thinking as you both are talking, you know, we as parents or educators or just community members, we all want our children to grow up to be healthy and adaptive members of the community. And as adults, we probably engage in sexual activity or engage in consuming alcohol or caffeine or nicotine. And so why do we create so much shame and stigma around what are pretty normal human behaviors for our youth populations and really create this sense of fear around these topics, right? When these are all really important health topics, sexuality, substance use, anxiety, depression, especially in our adolescents in our communities today, we just see unprecedented levels of these mental health issues. And when we don't know how to cope with what we're feeling or what we're experiencing, that is what leads us into unhealthy substance use, absolutely. And, you know, I was just thinking about that comment of the quelling the curiosity. If we don't have educators providing us with this medically accurate information, we're going to seek answers somewhere else, whether it's our friends or family, and those answers may not be medically accurate. We might not know what that information is, right. You know? And so it just seems to me like the evidence shows that giving our kids these skills as early as possible and these tools and these vocabularies, it really sets them up to be healthier in so many ways because it's just such a slippery slope and there's so much intersectionality among these unhealthy behaviors. And, you know, like when we, again, kind of go to our trusted people, we inherit their values. And so, yes, I had a lot of medically accurate information about sexuality, but I wasn't gifted the most beneficial attitudes towards sexuality, let's say, because I inherited my mother's. And my mother was a person with serious substance abuse and mental health problems. And so was she the best trusted adult to be getting this information from or learning these values from? Maybe not. And so again, I'm just lucky that I was able to have the education that I did, but even that was still, you know, not enough to really prevent some of those negative coping behaviors because it needs to be a community support. We need to all be in this together to support our youth and make sure there are as many opportunities available for guidance and accurate information as possible.
I love what you said about how adults are modeling the very behaviors we are shaming young people for engaging in. And it's Martin Luther King Day today, and I saw a news clip of when the young kids act like they are Martin Luther King and they give their speeches on this day. There was one young girl who was like, parents, adults, we see you. We see you name calling, bullying, all these behaviors that you're telling us not to do, but you're doing. We see you. She was like 8. So I love to always say, throw out to something is, what are we teaching the children? And so they see that. They see that we have a double standard. It's okay for us adults, but not. And so I just want to, you know, bring to the awareness that they see that and they see it as not quite right.
Well, I've been thinking a lot recently about the perspective of young children, because imagine that you're 6, 8, or 10 years old, you probably have an awareness that you're a child because people have probably ingrained in it in you that there are things you can't do and you probably physically can't reach the freezer and things like that. But you still have a very strong self-awareness of yourself as an independent person with rights and abilities to take action in the world. So even at that young age, we still see ourselves as players in society, and we are, because yeah, young children absolutely are. I mean, even as babies, we are soaking in this information that our parents are surrounding us with. And we, for better or worse, inherit those values and behaviors. And so it's very difficult when you're stuck in this, between this rock and a hard place of, this is exactly how you were taught and conditioned to be, but everyone's saying you're not allowed to be doing those things.
Well, and I empathize with the parents. Maybe it's part of the reason I'm not one. How do you teach a child not to do what you are doing? Mm-hmm. Well, A, I'm a legal adult who legally can do these things and you're not. So that's usually the first place you go. But I think that's why parents struggle, is because they know internally that they're sort of setting a double standard if they're saying, don't do this while I'm doing it over here. And how do you navigate that conversation? And so I empathize with parents. That's probably a pretty difficult place to be, especially if you weren't making good decisions through your adolescence.
Absolutely. And I do think that, you know, the key there is if we can kind of just be more comfortable having these real conversations with our children, even when they're pretty young, instead of the because I say so, because mm-hmm. I think that that is met with a lot of resistance and even more questions. But also, yeah, I mean, empathizing for the parents too, that everyone's parents are basically using the tools that their parents gave them. And my generation, at being 30 years old, were really some of the first kids who grew up in this realm of like, yeah, your feelings matter and like you should talk about things. And, you know, even that is relatively new. That's not the experience my parents or elders had, you know.
I think of my mom, who she was raised by a minister and his wife, both parents, but they weren't allowed to say the P word. And that P word was pregnant. And you're like, wow, right? I see your reaction. Like, what? That's like, who doesn't say pregnant? That's such, you know, I bet you were thinking of a different thing. And so when I had an older sister who was a teen parent, and so my, back to the original question, what was your sex ed like? My sex ed was, don't be like your sister. But nobody told me how not to be like my sister. That was in the home base. At school, I went to a pretty nice school with an auditorium separate from the cafeteria that had like a cinema-sized screen. And so I got to see cinema-sized pictures of the worst herpes you've ever seen. There it is. Don't get that.
With no advice on how to.
No skills. Yeah. No information on how you get something that looks that, you know, it's like, and so, yeah, they were attempting, but it was more through scare tactics, which didn't set me up to be successful in any way.
And the trainings that I have been going to and all that is, it's clearly a moving target because everyone seems to bring in their anecdotes as to how they've experienced certain things. And if you look at sort of this frame of reference, we've had several centuries of a white male supremacy in terms of our economies, our religions. We've had 100 years of psychotherapy and we're getting crazier. There's a certain amount of teachers and schools are set up in terms of what are our role, what isn't our role, what can we move aside. And comprehensive sex ed is a very, very holistic topic that continues to move. And I am a parent of a 16-year-old girl and a 14-year-old son. And this concern is very, very real to me. And I'm co-parenting. And I'm considered, or I consider myself a progressive. It's really complicated and it's really hard. A daughter versus a son, what I could be doing, what I should be saying. I would say anyone who's listening to this, it's not easy. No one I've met has it all figured out.
Give yourself grace.
Yeah. And also what I continue to hear when you talk about grace is it's okay to bring humor to this.
Oh, please.
The other thing I want to say as we're wrapping up, I want to touch on two points that I want to highlight. One is I represent a heteronormative part of our society. I'm a male. I'm heterosexual. I'm white. Okay. Middle class. And what I've seen in growing up is a lot of normalizing things that I would say are unhealthy. You know, I've been through therapy, I've been through marriage counseling, all of these type of things. And you're always looking for some version of solution to how to have what we'd consider to be a healthy relationship. You do this in your jobs. You have organizational people come in and work on how to work better together and these type of things. And what seems to be a start is creating awareness around being vulnerable, about looking at what your fears are, and trying to piece together healthy opportunities, mindfulness, having open and honest discussions. That the other thing that I wanted to, and so what I would just say to the men out there who are heterosexual is really examine yourself and looking in yourself as to constructs that have normalized in your own life, if it's of what success looks like or what you were supposed to do in order to feel like you liked yourself better, may not be right about, you know, in terms of, we'll call it relationships, whether or not it's male-female, whether or not it's male-male, whether or not it's female-female, or many others, okay? And the other thing I would say about why sex health and sex ed is important is because what we're learning more and more is there's sex identity, where you're born male, born female, and gender identity. And gender identity is showing up at a younger and younger age. And if you care about our children, which I will submit almost everyone is, we want to make sure that they feel like they're pure, like they're healthy, like they can love themselves, so and that they can understand if their gender identity isn't necessarily what my gender identity was, that doesn't make them right or wrong. And we give them the space to become aware of that. And that's what these type of courses help open up for people and then give them avenues of who they maybe can go to talk to more of. There's LGBTQ support groups in a lot of, if not most, high schools today and showing up at younger stages. But going to Google and putting in things or Pornhub or listening to Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion, and that we know our kids are getting this form, whatever you want to call edumacation, they're getting it because it's out there in society, and we're hoping that we could bring more holistic, more healthier, hopefully more researched way of understanding this.
Well, I just appreciate those sentiments so much, Arne. And, you know, I think it's interesting to look from a historical perspective that medical science has only been a respected field for like 200 years. And now women especially have so much more freedom with their sexuality. And yet there's the double-edged sword of that means that we have these we're bombarded with images of half-naked women all the time, creating these ideas of what the ideal woman is supposed to be. And I think that as a society, we're definitely moving away from this. But even with sex-positive images that are, you know, representing multiple styles of female bodies, it's like we're still inundated with these messages that to be valued, to be of worth in society, we have to be half naked, we have to have the right hair and makeup, the right clothes, and just all these things. And really the comment that I kind of wanted to close on today, though, is just kind of clarifying and confirming something that I heard from you guys. So Garfield County has historically had really high rates of teen pregnancy, to the extent that we even have a specialized high school program for teen parents, which I imagine is rather novel to rural communities. But it is my understanding that with the advent or implementation of programs like PrEP, that those statistics have been reduced.
The fertility rate at one point for 15 to 19-year-olds have been reduced by 66%.
Oh, wow.
After a time where... So when PrEP first came in, you know, only these few grades had it, and then these few grades had it. But as time evolved, pretty soon you've got students who have had all 4 years of this comprehensive curriculum, and you're seeing the fertility rate, which is live births per thousand of 15 to 19-year-olds, has been reduced by 66% at one point.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, like Arne said, these are serious public health issues and
economic
cause for concern for a
it,
variety
it costs
of reasons.
A lot less to train a few teachers, give them curriculum and integrate it into the education system than it does to pay for the welfare of a teen parent and their child.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's just, I think, to me, sold on the program. I just think that it really illustrates that it's getting to the root of what it's trying to do and actually making a tangible impact in our communities.
Yeah. It's not just because we think it's the thing to do. It actually is proven to have great results.
Thank you very much. Did you want to have anything that you say last?
No, I just want to say thank you for having this open conversation. I love it.
Well, I'll speak for all of us. We hope that you share this if you found value in it. And if you have any other questions, share it with us and we'll try to answer it in our next conversation.
Thanks, Arne.
Thank you, guys.
That was the second part of a two-part conversation about sexual health education in the Roaring Fork Valley between Maggie Saldine, peer recovery coach at MindSprings Health, Diana Andrews, former program manager of Garfield County Prep, and current program manager, Arne Manconi. For more information and the full conversation, you may visit kdnk.org. For more information about Garfield County Prep, garfieldcountyprep.org. Thanks for listening. Oh, we warmed the ground, we hushed our sound, we slept on